Now, Revelation 16:1 and verses forward thereafter. And I heard a great voice out of the temple saying to the seven angels, "Go ye and pour out the seven bowls of the wrath of God into the earth." And you'll find the same as in the Revised Version of 1881, American Standard Version 19:1, RVIC. Now, it's worth noting in the margin that where it says, out of the temple, the word for temple, Greek word naos, is like our word house. So what it's referring to is the temple house, not the court around it. And remember, ye are the temple of the living God. So it has something to do with the church, in particular, the church raised. Now, what it doesn't say is whether it's at the beginning of the raising of the sleeping saints around Christ's return, or whether it's the completion of the church. That we have to deduce that perhaps from other scriptures. And note it says, I heard a great voice out of the temple. So it implies that at least some of the temple has been constructed. That is through the raising of the saints that were already asleep in death at the time of our Lord's return. And it says a great voice out of the temple, implying that it either would be God or with Jesus. I think we can go to the next slide now. The context of Revelation 16:1 is found in chapter 15, and we'll summarize this a bit. There are three paragraphs in Revelation chapter 15. In the first, the seven last plagues correspond to the seven last plagues of Egypt in Exodus 8:20 to 12:36. And the Exodus plagues show us the major world events, while the Revelation plagues show us the effect of those major world events on Babylon. We look now at paragraph 2, and the essence of the message there is that the faithful are resurrected and praised at this point. Now, again, at the raising of the saints already asleep in death, or at the church specified in these verses, or going into the paragraph 5-8. And in this third and final paragraph in Revelation chapter 15, we note references here to Solomon's temple, really, the temple. Now, something interesting about the temple was that it was dedicated in the month before it was completed. It was dedicated in the seventh month, but it was not completed until the eighth month. The dedication of the temple or the opening of the temple would pertain to the raising of the sleeping saints. And we note two pieces of evidence, one from 1 Kings, time of Solomon, and one from Revelation 15:8, that the raising of the sleeping saints is accompanied by the smoke filling the temple in each case. The result of the smoke filling the temple in Solomon's temple was that the priests could not stand to minister the new covenant blessings. And in Revelation, the people cannot come to receive those blessings because the opening of the temple or dedication of the temple is the resurrection of the sleeping saints, and it is not sufficient that an incomplete priesthood would begin the ministering of the new covenant blessings, nor can the world come to the partially completed temple to receive the blessings of the new covenant in the age to come. So the blessings must await the completion of the church, the completion of the bride of Christ. And that is the prime message of chapter 15, leading us to chapter 16. and the seven last plagues. Now, how do we know what is meant by the seven last plagues being poured out and when they occur? We're given a picture of this in Joshua at Jericho. Now, I won't go into detail on this, but Joshua at Jericho explains about one third of the book of Revelation. Not in detail, but overall. That Joshua, the Greek form of his name is, we can go on to the next slide now. The Greek form, I think we can go on to the next slide. Next slide, please. There, that's it. So, the name Jehoshua means Jehovah saves. The Greek form of that name is Jesus. So Joshua is an apt type of Jesus Christ. And we'll note that the angel, the priests, there are seven of them with seven trumpets. They march around the city of Jericho 7 days, sounding the trumpets as they go. And that's why we can understand the seven trumpets of Revelation. They span the gospel age. And it also gives us the setting for the seven churches spanning the gospel age and the seven seals on the scroll spanning the gospel age. But we note that on the last day, they march around seven times. And so that shows us that the seven last plagues span the harvest of the gospel age. Now, does the seventh trumpet come at the beginning of the harvest or at the end of the harvest? Well, I think the answer to that is yes, but it does depend upon context. We won't go into detail here, but when Joshua goes around Jericho on the last day, with the seven priests and the seven trumpets. The sounding of the trumpet begins the first time they go around, and after they finish going around all seven times, then there's one last blast of the trumpet, and the wall of Jericho falls down. So, yes, depending on the context, are you referring to when they first start going around, at the beginning of the last day, or is it at the end when there's this last blast of the trumpet and the wall of Jericho falls down and it falls into the hands of the Lord's people? Again, I won't take time to read it now, but Matthew 24:31, 1 Corinthians 15:51 and 2, 1 Thessalonians 4:16 all indicate a sounding of the trumpet at the beginning of the harvest. On the other hand, Revelation 11:15 through the 18th verse, it would seem to refer to what happens at the end of the harvest. So we consider the context. Now, after they finish going around Jericho and there's the last blast of the trumpet and the wall falls down and the city falls into the hands of the Lord's people, including Rahab, who was not destroyed, and her home family. But then Joshua proclaims a curse on the rebuilder of Jericho. Now, that didn't happen until 6 to 7 centuries later, when a fellow called Heel the Bethelite tried to rebuild the city. And as was prophesied, he loses his firstborn at the beginning of the rebuilding of Jericho, and his lastborn with the setting up of the gates thereof. And that would correspond to something that has to be typified by something 6 to 7 centuries. What else could that be but the 1,000-year kingdom of Christ? So at the end of the millennium, we see a rebuilding of the idea of Jericho. And we see that in Joshua 6:26. So we can conclude from Joshua at Jericho that the gospel age is divided into seven periods of time, and the last period is also divided by seven events, circumstances, conditions, whatever. Now we can go to the next slide now. The separating of the peoples, which we see in Exodus 8, verses 20 to 23, and perhaps we would do well to read those, because we have 10 plagues in Egypt, but there's something that separates the first three from the last seven. And that will be Exodus chapter 8, starting with verse 20. And Jehovah said unto Moses, rise up early in the morning and stand before Pharaoh, who pictures Satan, for he cometh forth to water, and say unto him, thus saith Jehovah, let my people go that they may serve me. That's the thing that has been asked from the very beginning. Else if thou wilt not let my people go, behold, I will send swarms of flies upon thee and upon thy servants and upon thy people, and into thy houses, and the houses of the Egyptians shall be full of swarms of flies, and also the ground whereon they are. Doesn't sound like meals would be very fun to eat. And I will set apart in that day the land of Goshen in which my people dwell, that no swarms of flies shall be there, to the end that thou mayest know that I am Jehovah in the midst of the earth. And I will put a division between my people and thy people. By tomorrow shall this sign be. There are, in fact, two things that separate the peoples. One is that the plagues from here on, the last seven plagues, were to fall only upon the Egyptians. The other is that Moses takes the dominant role from that point on. For the first three plagues, he's only said, say unto Aaron thy brother, do this, do that, do the third thing. But from this point on, Moses takes the dominant role. That pictures for us that Moses, picturing Christ, at his return begins the harvest work of separating the peoples. And that's from Revelation 18:4. Come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. Then we have scriptures in Isaiah 52:11, Jeremiah 58, that we won't take time for. But we are to keep in mind that if we come out of Babylon, we are not to receive of her plagues. Now, a little side note, if we come out of Babylon and then proceed to partake of Babylon's sins, will we escape her plagues? Or will we be reckoned as another suburb of Babylon? So, the important thing for us should be, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins. And then as a consequence, we will not receive of her plagues. So I think now we can go on to the next slide. Here we have in one chart an attempt to parallel the Exodus plagues and the Revelation plagues and to see what the effects are of these plagues. The plagues in order in Exodus are the flies, the murrain, which is a deadly one, it kills, the blains, not deadly, but certainly annoying. Then the plague of the hail that kills the first two crops of Egypt. That's the, that would be the barley and the flax. But the wheat and the spelt has not yet come up. And that's why we have two offerings of the first fruits later on. We have the first offering, the first fruits, the barley, which pictures Jesus. And then later offering on day 50, we have the offering of the wheat, picturing the church. And this is shown here in plague number 4, which kills the first two crops of Egypt, the barley and the flax. And then several weeks later, the plague of the locusts, now that the wheat has come up and the spelt, it kills them too. Both deadly plagues. And then plague number 6, which is darkness. And last is a deadly plague once more, the death of the firstborn of Egypt. And the deliverance, of course, of the churchborn, church of the firstborn, the heirs of our Lord's kingdom. So if we compare what's happened since the 1870s, I think the Long Depression started in 1873, and then some events happened in the fall of 74 and the spring of 75 and Ottoman bankruptcy in October of that year. But I think that we can correspond the plague of the flies, not a deadly plague, with the Long Depression. The murrain that killed the cattle was a deadly plague of World War I. I think we'll have to get rid of a call here. So, the next plague, the blains on man and beast. Again, I think we can correspond this to the Great Depression. The hail, which is a deadly plague, destructive, World War II. The locusts, the Cold War, the East versus West, where one nation at a time, the communists took it over violently in most cases. Now, since the Cold War, which I think you might say ended about 1989, we have this plague of darkness, thick darkness that no man could move from his place for 3 days. Well, I had figured that we had the Long Depression, the Great Depression, and this would be a depression, a deep depression this time, and because it would be deeper and shorter than the previous two. But I did not see the idea of a pandemic. World War I had concluded perhaps as a result of the swine flu. But it does appear now that the coronavirus pandemic is going to be the trigger for depression. We will be watching to see if that happens. I see in a mirror darkly, as Paul says. And therefore, it's not surprising that I didn't see that the plague of the locusts was going to be a Cold War more than a World War III. But now that I can see it fulfilled, yes, that makes perfectly good sense. And the next major world event since then has begun with our pandemic, the plague of darkness that no man could move from his place for 3 days. Does that mean the international borders will continue to be shut until the third year, either late this year or the beginning of next year? That's something that we want to wait and watch and see. But it does suggest that what we might expect and plan on, tentatively at least, is that this is the last major world calamity before we get to Armageddon. Another time there might be opportunity to see how this pertains to Pharaoh's four objections during the seven last plagues there in Egypt. I might say that if one did not see that Christ had returned, it would not be easy to deduce these things here, the correspondence between the last seven plagues of the Exodus and the world events. Nor if one delayed the return of Christ to World War I, because it begins here with a non-destructive plague, and World War I was destructive. But we can understand it if we go back to the 1870s. Now, in the Revelation plagues, the first one was a plague poured out, and it's a bowl rather than a vial. It's big. It's poured out into the earth. Now suggests that the effect on Babylon is that the saints are called out of Babylon at that time. And the effect of the Long Depression is that it made it difficult for institutionalized Christianity to resist the truth because they were too busy with trying to maintain their financial liquidity. The second corresponding to World War I, into the sea, the kings lose out. I remember when I was in school, I used to say that Kaiser Bill went up the hill to have a look at France, and Kaiser Bill came down the hill with bullets in his pants. And the third plague, corresponding to the Great Depression, into the rivers, it was fundamentalism that was routed during the 1930s. The liberals became in control of all of the major theological schools and seminaries. The next plague, corresponding to World War II, destructive, was upon the sun, upon what they called their gospel. And it was the liberals this time that were being routed. The fundamentalism made a partial recovery, and also what came back was under the banner of neo-orthodoxy, which didn't attack the Bible directly. Now, the next one, the locusts, the Cold War, it's been especially the Roman Catholic Church and the Orthodox that have suffered most under it. The Orthodox Church in Russia, of course, is pretty much completely taken over. But we've seen now the Roman Catholic tradition being routed ever since the World War II and the beginning of the communist attacks on the Roman Catholic Church. And then if the pandemic is the trigger for a deep depression, we'll see one of the two things that the institutionalized church has left in its favor are its wealth and its people, the support of the world. And Armageddon would take care of the latter. Now, I won't spend a lot of time on it here, but we'll note that every major world event since our Lord's return has contributed one major step towards the restoration of Israel. What has been destructive to Babylon has been constructive to Israel. That's the Lord's economy again. The Long Depression began the return of the Jews to Israel. And today, over 45% are already back. World War I produced the Balfour Declaration, setting aside Palestine as a homeland for the Jewish people. And then came the Great Depression, the rise of fascism and Nazism. It drove the Jews from Germany. There were 600,000 Jews in Germany before World War I, at the beginning of the Depression. And now I think that there are fewer than 10,000 remaining. That's approximate. Then we come to World War II, and with Dachau and Auschwitz, it drove the Jews from Central Europe. The Cold War have been driving them from Eastern Europe. And I suggest that the pandemic and subsequent depression, I'm afraid, will drive them from the West as well. When we get to the last plague, that's when we get to Ezekiel 38 and 9, and that will result in the destruction of Babylon and the survival of Israel. I think now we can go on to the next slide. And that is the applications. That's what we want. What is Revelation doing for us? What does it tell us to do that we might not otherwise have realized? We consider that the gospel age harvest, that's now we're over almost 150 years into it, that as the true church and its light are diminishing, darkness is increasing. Do we see this in world religions, that they on average are becoming more corrupt? And that's certainly not restricted to that which professes Christianity, is it? That pertains to other religions as well. Do we see it in the political world? They say, trust the science. Well, I trust the science, but not the political scientists. As we look at what's happening in the world today, we notice it is liars who most accuse others of lying. And that brings us back to one of the four characteristics of our adversary. The devil literally means the accuser. Do we see lots and lots of accusation in the world today? I think we do. And I want to be cautious that when I hear accusations, am I hearing somebody covering up for himself? There's a saying among lawyers that if you're guilty of something, accuse your adversary before he accuses you. And then in trying to separate out truth from fiction as I hear it, who is it that cites the verifiable facts versus who is it that are calling people names and accusing of things, people of things, without even any specifics? A second, institutionalized Christianity is in trouble. They know it. We see that barriers are being broken down between Catholics and Protestants, that Protestantism is long gone. Only it's the protest is gone. It's only the ism that is still with us. And they want all the support they can get against the opposition of leftist atheists and Islamicists. Now, let's think. Who could get atheism and Muslims to cooperate? Are they compatible? By no means. Atheism, that there is no God, versus the Islamicists who say that their God is the only true God and everybody else is going to eternal torture. Now, when institutionalized Christianity wants our support, what do we do? We know we have opposition from atheists and from Islamicists, but do we join them? Or do we come out of her, my people, that she be not partakers of her sins? I think it is essential that we do the latter. And the word of the Lord is what tells us not to follow our gut feel, but to follow instructions which have been given to us in Revelation and the places that Revelation refers to. Now, this is true throughout the harvest. Let's go on to the next slide. And these are applications now for the later part of the harvest in which you and I live. If now we have entered the sixth of the seven last plagues, and the pandemic will lead to a deep depression, what should we do? I think there are two fundamental points. One, get out of debt. And two, stay out of debt. When the depression comes, how would we like it if somebody says to us, you know, I could have gotten through this pandemic and the deep depression if that blankety-blank Bible student had repaid me the debt he owes me. I think it's Romans 13:8 that says, owe no man anything but love. So again, I think the message is, get out of debt and stay out of debt. Now, another point. During lockdowns, quarantines, whatever you want to call them, let's use technology to keep in touch. We have telephones. Next, Skype was added to our arsenal. And then Zoom and Uber conference and so forth. We do well to use these and use them freely. I think they are not acts of the devil. The devil can take them over, as he has done many other places. But the technology is not corrupt. The use of it may be. And so if they can use it for ill, we can use it for good. Let's use these things and use them freely while we have the opportunity. Again, we notice that the Egyptian plague of darkness lasted for 3 days. So does that mean it's to be 3 years in our present time in the late part of the harvest? Will travel restrictions and lockdowns be canceled in 2023? And then in the post-lockdown phase, as has been mentioned earlier in the convention from Hebrews 10, 24 and 5, forsake not the assembling together. I think now we can go to the last slide. So here is the application to each and every one of us. Seeing that these things are thus all to be dissolved, what manner of persons ought ye to be in all holy living and godliness? Give diligence that ye may be found in peace in a troubled world, troubling one another, that ye may be found in peace, without spot, and blameless in his sight.